Welcome everyone to the sixth episode of the Science and Healthcare Sustainability Podcast. We're back in the UK. We've been to Germany in the last episode. We're back in the UK and we're back in the building. We've got Nicola here with us today to tell us all about her fantastic company and the work that they're doing.
Thank you for joining us. Much appreciated. First question, as always, what is sustainability to you?
So I think sustainability is about minimising our impact for future generations. There's a number of things you can look at, which is, you know, economic stability, sustainability, environmental and social. But really, it's that leaving a lasting legacy for future generations and not burning through all the fossil fuels, all the plastic.
So based on that, Nick, what do you think the problem in, or the scale of the problem is in laboratories?
Oh, it's the amount of single-use plastics and the waste disposal. So everything we use in cell culture, tissue culture, it's single-use plastics and it goes straight into incineration. Yeah. There's very little recycling in laboratories. And I think we could do a lot more. I think there's a lot that we could be done to recycle a lot of, like, the paper packaging, the cardboard and plastics that aren't contaminated or exposed to experimental.
How do you think the UK compares to the rest of the world on its kind of quest for sustainability? We've had a few people from different countries who have answered this question.
I think it's gaining traction in the UK biotech industry and life science industry. I think people are more aware and there's more products coming on the market to try and address this. So I think consumers have better options now in the UK. So people are looking to what they can do to be more sustainable as labs. But there's obviously the impact on the bottom line, really.
Yeah.
People are less reluctant to switch if it's going to impact on costs. And also if you've validated a certain flask or plastic ware in a SOP, you know, the amount of work that might be there to switch. So there probably is a little bit reluctance there, but I think people are getting more aware. And I think the UK is pretty good at publicising options. A lot of the scientific suppliers are publicising things that are more sustainable or are biodegradable or made of bio-based plastics. So there are options.
Yeah, so do you think there's an attitude change then? People are actually looking to be more sustainable and now the sort of infrastructure and the supplies are catching up, if you like.
Yes, and I think it's been driven a lot by the younger generation as well. So I think a lot of the younger people coming through into labs are actually sort of questioning, as they should.
Yeah.
Are these the right practices? Are these the right things we should be doing?
Brilliant.
And that's really, really good to see.
Do you see that within your company? Yeah. You see the younger generation?
Yeah, I definitely see that within the team. They're really keen to look at alternatives.
I think they've grown up with it as well. So
yeah.
They've grown up with recycling bins that maybe the older generation didn't. So they used to do it at home. Why wouldn't you bring it into the lab environment as well?
Yeah, very much so. There's no reason why you can't have a recycling bin in the lab, put the paper and packaging in and recycle that portion. Not everything needs to go in incineration waste. And that's what we need to be a bit more mindful for.
Yeah.
Brilliant. So tell us a little bit about what you do and where you do it. This is always the interesting part.
So I own a company called LabSkin Limited. We're based in York. We're based at the biotech campus in York. And we have a 3D full thickness human skin equivalent. So it represents the epidermis and dermis of human skin. So it looks and feels just like human skin. It's dry on the top. It's warm to the touch. So what we do is we use this as an alternative to testing on humans and animals for anything from skincare, cosmetics, either single ingredients right through to finished formulations. We can wound lab skin. So you can scratch it, cut it, gouge it, burn it, and watch it heal in real time.
Wow.
So there's a lot we can do with this little product. But the beauty of it as well is that it we can get enough replicates to have statistical significant data for people.
Amazing.
So you can support these claims, like you see, like anti-aging claims or moisturizing claims. We can support them with real data.
Incredible. And what inspired you to kind of start that, or how did you get into working there?
Well, I actually joined the a company called Innovent back in 2020. Actually, the week we locked down as a nation due to the pandemic.
Right.
And I joined as their chief scientist. And I was really impressed by the technology they owned, the LabSkin technology. It had been developed at the University of Leeds for the sole purpose of studying the skin microbiome. So it was two microbiologists at Leeds University that developed the LabSkin technology. They were interested in the microbiology, not the skin part. And so the technology has spun out into a company. So I loved what we were trying to do. Unfortunately, the business folded in 2023. So I bought the assets last year and restarted the labs again in York. So amazing. I've been so lucky that some of the team have come back. So we've got all the know-how, all the SOPs, all the equipment, and now we're bringing on board some of our old clients and lots of new clients as well.
Brilliant. That's quite a leap. You obviously have a lot of faith in the technology, but also in the scope. So yes. What industries would be able to use your product?
It's really got mass appeal. So we did focus when I was at Innovent, really focused on skincare and cosmetics companies. But it can be anybody now. So you can use it to look at transfer, so topical applications of pharmaceuticals, so you can look at that transfer through the skin. So we've looked at things like topical applications of insulin and ibuprofen, and you can map it tracking through the skin. So that's really cool. So it can be used for pharmaceuticals. We do wound healing, sort of any personal care products, anything that comes in contact with your skin, we can look at the effects that it has on the skin.
Cool.
Yeah, it really is. So what's been the biggest challenge, shall we say? So let's say since going back to LabSkin, since LabSkin became yours, your baby.
I think personally the biggest challenge has been moving from being an employee to being an employer. So now I have to make all the decisions, which that has been a personal challenge, and yeah, getting to grips with that. One of our biggest challenges was the previous business had 11 labs, and when we bought the assets, we just walked in and it was like they literally hung up the lab coats and hung up the pipettes. Everything was to be sorted through and tidied up. And I didn't have I don't have the budget for 11 labs. We've downscaled to 3.
Right.
So it was like, what do we need? What can we get rid of? And what's our focus for the business going forward?
Yeah, amazing. And I know you didn't just throw that equipment in the bin either. You found homes for it, believe.
Yeah, we sold a lot of it. We've even sold things to like Turkey and Thailand.
Yeah,
we've sold a lot of it. Yeah.
Well, that's true sustainability, isn't it? The reuse of things. So that's
Well, we've bought things as well, and I think we've bought things secondhand, and I think there is quite a booming business in the UK in secondhand lab equipment. People can see the value in it.
Yeah.
And we had things that we had really good provenance on, so we knew how much had been used, we knew all the purchasing details, the lifespan, the service history, so that was really attractive to people.
Yeah, it's a good point. I mean, I would imagine a lot of projects, particularly in academia, are funded for sort of 3 or 5 years, and that equipment's still good after 3 or 5 years, so I would imagine there's a big market for the secondhand equipment.
Yeah, there is, yeah. And we've looked at buying things that we needed for the lab.
Mm. Yeah. So how's the market responded since the sort of rebirth of LabSkin, if you like?
Oh, it's been really, really interesting. So we've had some of our clients come back on board really quickly saying, oh, I'm so pleased you guys are back. We've really missed you. Some of the alternatives weren't as good. So we've brought some clients on really quickly and had repeat business, which is amazing.
Yeah, brilliant.
And then reaching out to new people that have never heard of us, which is great. That's always interesting. So the response has been really, really welcome, really good, really positive. And for me, it's been really reassuring because it's like, yes, I am doing the right thing.
Yeah. Great. So it sounds like there's not many people doing what you do, or if any.
No. There's a few really good key competitors out there, but we have a real uniqueness in our product. So we use an unusual scaffold. It's not really a scaffold. It's a protein gel base that we seed the fibroblasts into, and then they release their own extracellular matrix that we can then seed the top layers onto for the keratinocytes.
Right.
But interestingly, that method allows the cells to produce antimicrobial peptides, which means we can put microbes directly onto the surface. So I could swab your cheek and put your whole skin microbiome onto lab skin.
Wow.
And then I could look at how products interact with your microbiome, but also how your microbiome interacts with skin.
Amazing.
So that's our unique selling feature, really, of lab skin. That's one of our USPs.
So effectively, you could have Luke's profile, and he could ask you which skin products would best suit his skin profile without actually having to.
So it's like personalised medicine or personalised
skincare products. Yeah, and we did something for the BBC. So I was contacted at the start of June. Really weird phone call. Got a phone call from the BBC saying, would we like to participate in a feature on adult acne?
Right.
And I was like, yeah, sure. At this point, I was like, in Sheffield, helping Unicorn move their labs into their new building. Already like halfway through a lab fit out in York. Everything was just chaos. And they're like, when would you like to do it? So we ended up, me and Bart, one of my scientists, we ended up catching the train from York to King's Cross, swapping two skinfluencers by the flower stall in King's Cross Station.
Skinfluencers.
Nobody batters an eyelid. But there were gloves and swabs and ice boxes swabbing these people. Brought their microbiome back to York and put them onto lab skin. And then we tested an anti-acne formula that you can just buy over the counter in Boots or any other pharmacy.
Yeah.
And then we tested one of the products one of the skinfluencers was using to manage her acne.
Right.
And we showed that the skinfluencers product of choice actually reduced the number of acne-causing bacteria on the skin, but caused a massive increase in pro-inflammatory markers. So it was probably causing irritation and inflammation in her skin.
Interesting.
Yeah, that was really interesting. Whereas the over-the-counter one didn't cause that inflammation.
Wow.
So that was really, really interesting.
Yeah. So these brands should probably be using people like yourselves to test their products, shouldn't they, before they launch them into the market?
Proper skin influencing.
Yeah, there's a lot we can do. So we can look at, you know, when people say, oh, I've got this wonderful anti-aging moisturiser, we'll prove it.
Mm.
We can prove it by looking to see if it boosts collagen and elastin and other proteins in your skin, which would lead to that smoothness, that less aged appearance.
Yes.
We can look at hydration levels. So when you say, oh, it moisturises for 72 hours, we can prove that by testing the hydration levels over time.
Yeah. There's no hiding, is there?
No, absolutely no hiding.
Is there no laws that they should have to prove that already?
No, not really. For most cosmetics and personal care products going on the market, there is just have to show that it's sterile, it's not going to cause an adverse reaction.
Well, 80% of people who tried it said they thought their skin might have been a slightly little bit more moist than it was before.
Yeah.
And the interesting fact about those studies was I always see them when you see like, oh, 75% of 60 people said this was great. You only need 21 people for those cohorts.
Right.
That's the minimum.
21.
21, yeah.
Wow.
You only need to test on 21 people. Yeah.
You're not getting a lot of diversity there, are you, either, I suppose?
No, not really.
So we should look for a label, shouldn't we, really, saying lab skin tested, or where is it? What can people look for on a label that shows that it has actually been properly tested? Is there any notifier that says
no,
it's been done properly?
Not really, no. Clients that we work with that love the data we generate, they will sort of shout about it more in their marketing and put things like scientifically proven.
Right.
We do have a microbiome friendly standard, and you get a little logo that you can put on your website or packaging, which is microbiome friendly, powered by Lab Skin.
Oh, okay, right.
So that's just one of the tests we do. So we're bringing a whole range of microbiome tests on board.
I'd pay attention to that.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what objections do you generally come across, and how do you overcome them? I know we spoke about the size of the skin, if you like.
We only produce small pieces. They're about the size of a thumbnail, but they are the thickness of human skin. We can't produce massive amounts. It's just not cost effective. And one of the biggest pushbacks we do get is usually on cost, because it takes 28 days to grow in the lab, so that's 28 days of manpower. And these are using primary human cells, which aren't cheap, and all the media and components and plasticware and things we use aren't particularly cheap.
Yeah.
So we usually get pushback on cost. We try and work with our clients to give them as much information as they can. So running one experiment on lab skin, you can look at things like the moisture, like the changes in protein profiles. You can look at the inflammation. You can do that all at the same time.
Right.
So you get more bang for your buck.
So the data you're getting is
cost effective and relevant. That tends to be one of the biggest pushbacks. Timelines as well, because you tell me you want to run a study, I've got to grow the lab skin. I'm not just going to keep churning it out wasteful. So then you've got a 4-week lag time before we then do your experimental work, which can take 2 to 3 weeks to complete. Then we've got the data analysis and the reporting. So quite often there's a little bit of pushback on timelines and cost.
Okay. So you told us why the product is quite unique in the market and all the amazing benefits. But how is it sustainable, would you say? Is there any benefit to the environment from lab skin?
Yeah, so from one tiny vial of cells, we can create so many plates of lab skin. So it's really expandable. And these cells tend to come from surgical excisions, so the byproducts of cosmetic surgery. So that's quite a unique way of using something that would probably just get incinerated. We try and reuse as much of the plastics as we can. And we've actually switched to using quite a lot of glassware. So we've gone back to autoclaving glass bottles and things. So when we do our specialist media preps, we'll do them in the glass bottles rather than using plastics and throwing that away. So we try to be as sustainable as we can. But one of our biggest, I suppose, USPs is that we're quite a good alternative to animal testing.
Right.
So we provide a different platform to having to test on mice and rats. And a more physiological relevance platform. Testing on animals.
So not only is the data you're getting more relevant, as you say, but actually animal testing, my understanding, is quite wasteful. There's bedding, there's feeding, there's watering, and then there's cleaning, and then there's changing the bedding, and then unfortunately those animals do die, so then there's risk disposal of those. I mean, it's a hugely wasteful science in some respects. So it sounds like a much more sustainable way of doing it and relevant, as you say. So actually the result is actually going to be more akin to what you'd expect in humans.
With that in mind, what is the most wasteful thing that you do, would you say? And what do you do to kind of combat that? Or what sustainable changes have you made?
So the most wasteful thing we do is the cell culture itself, because it's just single-use plastics. Every stripper, every flask, every plate that we use, it's all single-use plastics. So what we try and do is recycle as much as we can. So all the packaging we try and recycle, so all the outer casings that don't come into contact with anything in the lab or come into contact with anything biological, we'll recycle. Using glass where we can, and looking, can we reuse things sometimes? Is there a way we can clean things, reuse things, recycle as much as we can?
Yeah. You're our second guest who's kind of alluded to that we'd probably go back to some of the older practices where we were using glassware or we were reusing things or things didn't need to be single use. And we've kind of got into this habit of using single use products because that's the done thing now, when actually it doesn't, scientifically it doesn't require it, and also sterility wise it doesn't require it. So look, I think looking for those easy wins of going back to the old ways is quite good and normally more cost effective as well, because obviously at the end of the day you're a business. The more affordable or more cost effective you can make your product, the easier the discussions are with the bigger companies who are looking to do the testing, and you can be a bit more competitive on price as well, I would have thought.
Anything that helps reduce like the bottom line is always good, isn't it?
Absolutely. Can labs be fully carbon neutral, or do you think there's always going to be an element of waste within laboratories?
No, I really don't think you can. When I look at everything in our labs, from the CO2 incubators, from the incubators, from the fridges, freezers, all the plasticware, I really really don't think we can.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's going to be difficult, isn't it? There's always a need, particularly with your product needs to be clean and sterile. Yeah. You need to use some single-use stuff.
Yeah, it'd be really difficult. I mean, we try and switch to, as much as we can, bio-based plastics, plastics that contain, you know, recycled plastic if possible.
Yeah.
Looking at proper biodegradable cleaners, laundering lab coats. We don't use single-use lab coats, disposable lab coats. Recycling what we can, recycling tip boxes. Or even, you know, we'll even stick them in the dishwasher and donate them to the primary schools because they've got nice little boxes for the kids to play with. Brilliant. Anything like that, really. But, yeah, I just can't see us ever being fully carbon neutral.
Yeah. You speak to Danielle, who was our first guest on here. She's the CEO of Recycle Lab. They take hazardous plastics and recycle them. So that's another step forward. It's never going to be carbon neutral, but still, it's better than the incineration and
the alternative. Yeah, I mean, I've been in this industry a long time now, and I can remember washing out tips and then re-racking them. I don't think people are willing to do that anymore, really.
No.
Well, you're always going to have transport.
There's,
I suppose, there's certain levels of inevitable waste and carbon emissions.
Yeah. I mean, we're quite lucky, really, on the science park in that we do get a lot of the big suppliers deliver regularly to us, so we are everybody that's housed on the science park kind of comes on the same delivery, so we're not having multiple deliveries.
That's good.
Everything kind of gets grouped together, so that does cut down on some transport costs. We try as well to use local suppliers where possible. So things like the histology that we do, there's a really good York-based histology company, so we'll buy things from them where possible. Use local printers. Local couriers, and try and just cut down on unnecessary like travel like that.
Yeah, very good. And you recently won an award.
We did. In New York. That was exciting. Yeah, made in Yorkshire.
Excellent.
Yeah, so we won in the medical devices and life sciences category.
Brilliant.
Real surprise.
Yeah.
For being less than a year up and running.
Yeah, it's incredible.
It was amazing. And the feedback was so positive from the judges. They said it was a really good application. And also that they could see real commercial potential in the company.
Yeah.
So that's really nice, isn't it? Now I get to go to the Made in UK award.
Are you going to the next level, do you? Okay.
Wow. So there's all regional ones from around the UK.
Yeah, fantastic.
It's here in lovely Liverpool in June.
Is it?
Yeah.
Okay, brilliant.
Yeah.
The weather'll be better then.
Yeah, fingers crossed. What three things would you implement in a lab in terms of sustainability now, if you could?
If I could, I think one of the ones is recycle. So recycle as much as you can on the paper and plastics and, you know, the packaging that comes through.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite difficult because we're on a science park and they just have black bin waste or yellow incineration waste, but we've introduced recycling and put it into the group recycling. But the park itself is trying to be more sustainable as well, so they're looking at their waste management and putting more in place there, which is really good. If money was no object, obviously I'd get everything like fridges, freezers, incubators to be, you know, A-star rating. And really energy efficient. But to that end, we just turn things off when we don't need them. And that's one of the main things. We've got like plug sockets on timers and that kind of thing, so they're not in use all the time. I think the temptation sometimes is just to walk out the lab and leave everything running. And we don't. And then the third thing was I'd love to see more sustainable products really on the market. So it's coming through. It'd just be great to have more choice.
And a little bit more cost effective.
Yeah, I mean, there's some that aren't, you know, they're not that much more expensive than things we buy, but it would be great to have things on a par and be given that choice, really.
Yeah.
Have more choice.
Do you think it's worth paying a little bit of an uplift for sustainability?
I'll happily pay a little bit of an uplift for sustainability.
Yeah. I think we need people like yourself who are willing to pay as an early adopter, because then the economies of scale will bring the price down. We were talking Joel from Green Elephant last week, and he was saying, yeah, they are more expensive. There's a technical benefit to their product. So actually, if you look at the lifespan of the product, it's actually cheaper.
Yeah.
But there is an initial purchase price that's more. And he said, as soon as more people adopt it, they can bring the price down.
Yeah.
So it does take some early adopters to sort of embrace it.
Yeah, it's that benefits economics piece, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Just picking up on something you said about turning things off. I mean, we're all My Green Lab ambassadors here, and the first sort of module of the course is basically just turn things off, like simple things like that. Make sure the lights are off. Water bath doesn't need to be on all night. It can be turned off and put on a timer.
Yeah.
Turning taps off. It's those simple things that we do at home that we should probably bring into work as well.
Yeah, I mean, well, as a business owner, you're now the one paying the bills. Yeah.
Someone leaves the lights on overnight. It's like the kids leaving their bedroom lights on.
It still has
to be paid for.
Yeah.
But just lights on sensors makes a huge difference.
Yes. Yeah. We're looking at most of our lights on sensors, and we do use the timers on plugs. And
you might have noticed we sit upstairs with the lights off. Not to do with sustainability so much. Everyone have a bit of a doze every now and then. I know we touched on it earlier on when the camera's off, but tell us about the exciting plans you've got for LabSkin in the future.
So one of the real reasons why I wanted to buy the company was the potential I could see there. So for a long time, it's just been LabSkin, and we call it LabSkin S for LabSkin Standard, very much like Caucasian skin. So it's fibroblast keratinocytes, full thickness. So we're just launching LabSkin M, and that's got melanocytes in there. They're the cells that give skin pigmentation. And we've got melanocytes from different donors on the Fitzpatrick scale. So that's different shades of darkness. So we can match different ethnicities.
Nice.
We've got a disrupted skin barrier model, which we're calling LabSkin AD for atopic dermatitis. So we can mimic atopic dermatitis, psoriasis, eczema, and look at how products will heal that skin barrier and return the skin to skin health. And then because we've got melanocytes in there, we're going to look at creating a melanoma model. So trying to create a product that will be able to test treatments for skin cancer.
Amazing.
And then I'd like to move on to an immune model, putting in true immune cells like macrophages that will respond to irritants on the skin, but also respond to wound healing. So they'll migrate to the site of wounding. And then I've got a long list after that. So we keep getting asked about, can we create hair follicles? Can you put nerves in there? Can we add an adipose layer to make the fatty layer under the skin? And
so many options. If you think about it, what you can do with skin, so many options.
Yeah, you just have to be mindful of trying to do everything everywhere all at once.
But like as Alex said, the possibilities really are endless, aren't they? And the markets as well. You've got cosmetic, beauty, aesthetics, military, and then now cancer research sort of true medicine as well.
So yeah, that's it. We'd like to move more into sort of pharmaceutical and therapeutic, to having the right constructs, the right models for people to use in their research is really important to us.
Yeah.
We're a team of scientists being led by the scientist.
Yeah.
We want to appeal to scientists.
Yeah, wherever humans go, skin goes. So skin in space.
Well, funny you should say that. We are working with a researcher in the US who is interested in the effects of time in space on cardiomyocytes and skin.
Right.
So being in space, doing space travel, impacts on your heart cells, which impact on your skin cells. So we're looking to possibly try and do a co-culture of cardiomyocytes and skin.
Wow. And it's topical at the moment as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because I was reading about the massive effect on bone density and
huge.
All that sort of thing from being stuck up there. And
those two guys have been up there for nine months.
Are they down now?
No.
On their way? Are they on their way?
Yeah. I don't think they've rescue pods arrived.
Right.
And I think they'll be coming back shortly.
I think they'll be quite happy to get back.
I think they'll be well prodded and poked when they come back.
Oh, so. Did you read about the compensation?
No.
Oh, it's huge,
insane.
Isn't it? Yeah.
Insane. Send me up to space for 9 months.
I actually enjoyed it though, other than I've had quite, they've missed out on Thanksgiving and Christmas and probably birthdays and things. Yeah. But actually,
I think you'd have to find some way of enjoying yourself up there. Otherwise you would lose the plot, wouldn't you?
Well, wouldn't you? Yeah. Maybe. fascinating. Because not many people get that opportunity.
No. No. But brilliant.
Is there any specific products you'd recommend other labs to use that are sustainable? Have you used anything in the past you thought that was brilliant? Everyone should be using that.
No.
Okay, scratch that one.
I mean, I'd love to use like the bio bins. I think they'd be really good, but all our incineration bins are provided by the campus.
Yeah.
So we need to get them switched over.
I think Dan from Iconics, who owns the company, I think he finds that a lot. You know, he'll speak to labs who really want to use them, but their waste providers potentially don't accept them. So it's kind of a chicken and egg situation. So, you know, we need to maybe get a waste provider on and talk to them.
Yeah,
and
see what let's do that. That's our job, isn't it, to crack them.
I think just look to how you can reduce the amount of single-use plastics that you have. So things like pipette tips are now coming in cardboard packaging.
So,
amazing. Yeah.
There we go.
So that's all recyclable, which is brilliant. So all the cardboard goes into cardboard recycling, and you just put the tips into your box that you're using.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Yeah. Excellent.
Much less packaging, much less single-use plastic.
So yeah,
things like that we need more of.
Yeah, you're right. It's just
we think these are great.
Well, they're a no brainer, aren't they? I mean, why does the rack need to be made of plastic? It doesn't.
Well,
it has always been just plastic cheap and it's easy to sterilise and all those arguments. But there's no reason for it to be.
And for labs, it's difficult to get rid of the plastic waste as well, because quite often people will shy away from it. You know, it's been in a lab; it'll have to be incinerated. Yeah. Like I mentioned earlier, we often just pop the tip boxes in the dishwasher and then donate them to schools or plant them up and things.
But actually,
the cardboard boxes are so much better for the environment, and it's such a simple idea, really. Yes, I mean, we need more of this.
No, I agree. You win on the way in and the way out there. It's a renewable resource it's made of, but also, as you said, it's easier to get rid of. It's easier to recycle. A bit like the plates behind you. Our Ventus plates. There's no reason why the surround has to be made of virgin plastic. That can be made of plant-based material, which that one is. But obviously the wells need to be virgin polypropylene because they need good thermal conductivity and all those science reasons, if you like. But
the
rest was just something to hold the wells. You know,
that's clever.
Yeah, it's smart, isn't it? That's really smart. Right, we need more sort of innovation like that.
Yeah. Where can people learn more about your organisation?
Well, we're all over LinkedIn, thanks to my business development manager.
Very good.
I'd like for Stuart to come on the podcast.
You should get Stuart on the podcast.
Yeah, Stuart.
Yeah. And then our website, www.labskin.co.uk. That's the main source of all our resources and inspiration and everything we do.
And I believe you're presenting tomorrow in Liverpool.
I am. I'm presenting at the Skin Microbiome in Healthy Aging Conference tomorrow. We'll be at In Cosmetics in Amsterdam on the 8th to 10th of April. We have a stand. Come and see us.
Excellent.
We'll try and get this out before then, otherwise it'll make no sense.
Yeah, no, we will. Is there anyone else you'd recommend that we talk to?
Have you spoken to the Wasteless Bio team?
No.
Okay, so they're really interesting. They're a team of young grads in Ireland that have come up with an idea to try and create a circular bioeconomy. So they're taking excess plastics, lab consumables, things that people don't use anymore, pieces of equipment as well, and either offering them at massive discounts or for free. We've given them lots of things for free. And just circulating them around startups or academic labs that will make use of them. As we found when we were clearing out our 11 labs, that we had so much excess consumables, and a lot of it was expiring or just expired. I was really lucky that one of the local universities in York St John's, they took a lot for their teaching labs because they didn't need things to be sterile or in date. And their budgets are being massively cut. So that Andy there was amazing. He just came and filled his car up with stuff.
Great.
In fact, he's coming back later this week to do the same.
Brilliant.
But I think that's one thing we should do more of, actually, is sharing. The temptation is just to chuck it in the bin, isn't it? Chuck it in the skip. And there's other people that can make use of what you consider to be our rubbish is another man's goal.
Yeah,
absolutely. As you say, it kind of passes down the chain, doesn't it, from, you know, you're producing, so it needs to be high quality, down to, you know, teaching in universities, and then even down to school teaching, you know, it kind of,
yeah,
it can be passed down the chain of sterility and quality, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, the number of times, my sister's a school teacher, and the number of times I've given her lab coats or tips or expired plastics for the kids to play with, and, you know, they love it.
Yeah.
Because they think they're being scientists.
Teacher scientists. Yeah. You're inspiring them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's what we should do, really.
Yeah,
definitely. Oh, absolutely.
Well, we'd love to come and see the labs at some point and come and see them. Yeah, it sounds amazing.
Come and poke some skin.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Well, thank you very much for joining us. Hit like and subscribe and the bell icon and all those things that you do with cool podcasts that you want to listen to again. And we've got some pastries here, which we need to eat.
Yeah, thank you to our sponsors, CG Optics and Lampadina Group, who sponsor the podcast and provide pastries and give us some time off to do it. So we appreciate that.
Yeah.
And the staff.
Yeah.
Thanks, Nick.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Science and healthcare.